Imagine you buy like a winning lottery ticket, right? You scratch it off, you see all the matching numbers, and you are just,
Oh,
ecstatic.
yeah. You're already spending the money in your head.
Exactly. But instead of the clerk at the gas station handing you a big stack of cash, they hand you, wait for it, a ticking time bomb, a binding legal contract for like 5,000 barrels of crude oil, and a bill for 10 grand.
Which would be terrifying.
You'd think you were totally hallucinating, but actually, welcome to the derivatives market.
Yeah, it really is the ultimate bait and switch if you aren't prepared for it, because the mechanics of getting your money are just completely divorced from what your intuition, tells you should happen.
Right, exactly. And navigating that bizarre reality is exactly what we are doing today. But real quick, before we jump into the deep end, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Got to pay the bills.
You know it. So if you are staring down the barrel of the Series 3 exam, they've got a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and like unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing.
Highly recommend checking them out at certfuel.com.
Yeah, definitely do that. Okay, so let's get into it. We are conquering the absolute beast of the Series 3 exam today. I'm talking about options exercise, assignment, and settlement.
And just to put the stakes on the table for you, the material we are covering right now, it accounts for roughly 71% of the exam across the first seven chapters.
71%. That's a big deal.
It is the engine under the hood. I mean, you cannot pass the Series 3 without fundamentally understanding this stuff. But, and this is key, memorizing a textbook is a massive trap here.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
If you just try to rote memorize the definitions of exercise and assignment, the exam writers, they're going to twist the phrasing, they'll change the context, and you'll just freeze up.
Right. They smell fear. They totally prey on that.
They really do. So our mission today is to reverse engineer the actual logic of the market. We need to understand why the rules operate the way they do.
Because if you understand the why, you can basically dodge any curveball.
Yeah, exactly. The correct answer will be, the only one that mathematically and logically makes sense.
I love
Okay.
that. We aren't just memorizing rules. We are building like a mental model. And to make this stick for anyone listening, because honestly, standard dry finance lectures just slide right off my brain thanks to ADHD, we are going to cast a few actors in our mental theater today.
I think this is crucial because terms like the holder and the grantor, they're just faceless. We need to visualize the real people taking these risks.
Yeah, totally. So first up in our cast is Panicked Pete. Pete is he's our option buyer, the holder, and Pete is frankly a nervous wreck.
Poor Pete.
Right. He's a retail trader. He paid his option premium up front, and now he is just clutching his little digital option ticket, constantly sweating, staring at red and green candles on his monitor.
Just absolutely terrified of what the market is going to do next.
Exactly. I mean, he bought the option because he wanted limited risk, but the anxiety is still like eating him alive.
Pete really represents that classic retail mentality. He wants the upside, he paid for the privilege, but he's terrified of the actual mechanics.
Yep. And then on the exact opposite side of Pete's trade, we have wealthy Wanda. Wanda is the option writer, the grantor.
I always picture Wanda lounging on the teak deck of
Yeah.
like her mega yacht, casually sipping a martini.
Oh, 100%. Probably wearing those incredibly expensive oversized sunglasses.
Right. And Wanda, she writes option contracts for a living. She essentially acts like the insurance company. She collects the premium from nervous people like Pete. And in exchange, she takes on this massive open-ended risk.
But she's totally unbothered.
Completely. She is cool, calculating, highly capitalized, and she knows that statistically, most of the options she writes are going to expire worthless anyway. She's just collecting the decay.
So she sold the risk, pocketed Pete's cash, and now she's just, enjoying the ocean breeze. But, and this is the kicker, if it were just Pete and Wanda, the whole system would collapse.
Oh, absolutely.
Because Pete would be screaming at Wanda across the internet. Wanda would just ignore him from her yacht, and nobody would trust the market. So we need a referee. Enter our third character, Clearinghouse Carl.
And we should clarify, Clearinghouse Carl is not a human being. Carl is a stoic, robotic, perfectly neutral algorithm.
I literally picture him with a barcode scanner for a face, wearing a little black and white striped referee shirt.
That works perfectly. And Carl, he does not care about Pete's anxiety, and he does not care about Wanda's yacht. Carl exists for one reason only.
To guarantee the integrity of the market.
Right. He sits squarely in the middle of every single transaction to make sure that, you know, everyone honors their obligations, no matter how much money is on the line.
Okay, so we have our cast. We've got Pete the Nervous Buyer, Wanda the Wealthy Writer, and Carl the Cyborg Referee. So let's look at the grand illusion of the market.
Let's do it.
Let's talk about what happens when an option is actually exercised. Because I'll be honest, when I first studied this, my instinct was completely wrong.
Most people's instincts are.
Yeah. So if Panic Pete exercises a profitable in-the-money corn option, my brain immediately assumes he is getting corn. Like, he clicked a button, and now an 18-wheeler is literally backing into his driveway to dump 5,000 bushels of corn on his lawn.
Which would be hilarious, but no.
Right. Or at the very least, I figured Carl shows up with a giant publisher's clearinghouse check for the cash value.
And see, this is exactly what the exam writers know your brain is doing. They totally prey on that instinct. If Pete exercises an option on a futures contract, he gets absolutely zero physical corn and he gets zero cash.
This blew my mind. He gets nothing tangible.
He gets a futures contract. That's it. The moment Pete exercises, he is instantly dropped into a live, open futures position at the strike price of his option. He trades his option ticket for a futures contract.
Okay, wait, I have to stop and figure this out. Why? Pete bought an option on corn. Why doesn't he just get the corn?
Because you have to look at what the underlying asset actually is. In this market, you are dealing with an option on a future. It is a derivative of a derivative.
Oh, man. It's like the movie Inception. We are two dream levels down.
Exactly like Inception. The physical corn is the waking world. The futures contract is the first dream layer. And the option, well, that's the second dream layer.
Okay, so the underlying asset of the option is not the physical commodity at all.
Right. The underlying asset is the futures contract itself. So when Pete invokes his right, when he hits that exercise button, he is demanding delivery of the underlying asset. And that asset is simply a piece of paper, a futures contract.
Okay, so if the option is deeply in the money, let's say Pete made a brilliant call and he's theoretically up, I don't know, $10,000, he hits exercise. Carl the Cyborg hands him a futures contract. Where is the actual money?
That's the big question.
Yeah, like how does Pete actually capture his profit if Carl doesn't hand him a briefcase full of cash?
So the profit is realized through the ordinary daily mechanics of the futures market. Let's walk through it.
Okay, walk me through it.
Pete exercises, and Carl instantly creates a futures position for Pete at the option strike price. Let's say the strike price was $5. But the current market price of the future is $6.
Okay.
Pete just got a contract valuing the asset at $5 when it's actually worth $6.
Right. So he has a built-in $1 of profit per unit.
Correct. But he doesn't get a check for it immediately. What happens is that at the end of that trading day, Carl marks Pete's new futures position to market.
Ah, the daily settlement.
Exactly. Carl looks at the settlement price, sees that built-in profit, and credits that difference to Pete's account as variation margin. The profit shows up as a mark-to-market accounting gain in his futures account, not as some lump sum payout from the option exercise itself.
Okay, listen up. You know what they are going to do on the test here, right?
Yeah, they love this trick.
They are going to set up a scenario where Pete exercises an in-the-money option, and one of the multiple-choice answers is going to say, the clearinghouse delivers the physical commodity. Or the clearinghouse pays the intrinsic value in cash. And if you aren't paying attention, you're going to click it because it sounds like a happy ending.
It is the most common trap on this topic.
Yeah.
You must remember that physical delivery of a commodity is a completely separate, entirely different event. It belongs strictly to the futures contract's delivery process, which, you know, happens much later, and only if Pete actually holds that future until its own expiration.
Right. Exercise just births the future. What happens in the future is a problem for tomorrow.
Precisely.
All right, let's test this. Listener, I want you to think about this scenario for a second. Panicked, Pete is sweating. His hand is trembling on his mouse, but he finally hits the button. He exercises an in-the-money option on crude oil. What does he physically or electronically hold in his account 3 seconds after he clicks that button?
Think about it.
He holds a futures position. No cash. No barrels of oil rolling down his street. Just a brand new margined futures contract.
If you can anchor that inception concept in your mind, that options deliver futures and only futures deliver commodities, you will dodge a huge cluster of trick questions on this exam.
Okay, so we know what happens when Pete pulls the trigger. But wait, let's look at the calendar, because time is definitely running out for Panicked Pete.
Always. Time decay is real.
Yeah, and this is where things get incredibly stressful for retail traders. I want to talk about the ticking clock and the two possible exits Pete has.
The calendar is where the market is just entirely unforgiving. If you miss a deadline in the derivatives market, Clearinghouse Call does not have a customer service line you can call to complain, you know.
Carl does not care.
He really doesn't. So when an option holder like Pete wants to close out his position, he has two potential exit doors. But those doors lock on entirely different schedules.
Okay, so what are the two deadlines? Let's break them down.
You have the last trading day, and you have the expiration date, which is sometimes called the exercise date.
Let me guess. The exam is going to try to convince me that these are the exact same day.
Every single time. And while they can be the same day for some specific products, structurally, they are two entirely different concepts. Let's separate them.
Okay.
The last trading day is exactly what it sounds like. It is the absolute final moment that the option itself can be traded on the exchange. It is the last day Pete can offset his position.
And by offsetting, you mean Pete goes into the open market and just like sells his option to somebody else to close his position. He bought a ticket from Wanda, and now he's just selling the ticket to a new guy named Steve.
Exactly. He is closing his open interest by taking the opposite action in the market. But that window closes on the last trading day, after the bell rings on that day. The secondary market for that specific option just ceases to exist.
The ticket booth is boarded up. Everyone went home.
Oh.
Okay, so what is the expiration date then?
The expiration date is the final day. The holder may exercise the option and convert it into a futures position.
Okay, so if the ticket booth is boarded up, Pete can't sell the ticket to Steve anymore. But if the expiration date hasn't passed yet, he can still walk up to the main gate, hand the ticket to Carl, and demand his futures contract.
That is a perfect way to look at it. And this is exactly why it is so critical to know that the last trading day often falls before the expiration date. The market might say, hey, you can trade this option until Thursday, but you have until Friday afternoon to decide if you want to actually exercise it.
I can already see the exam question for this. They're going to say, Pete is holding a long call. Today is Friday. The option expires today. The last trading day was yesterday. Can Pete offset the option?
And the answer is absolutely not. The last trading day has passed. The offset door is locked, bolted, and bricked over.
Wow.
From that moment until expiration, Pete's only choices are to exercise the option and take the futures contract, or let the option expire and die.
So he is literally trapped in a hallway with only two doors left.
Okay, so speaking of when you can exercise, this brings up the whole American style versus European style debate.
Right.
Which, honestly, sounds like we're ordering a tailored suit, not trading derivatives.
Yeah.
What do these styles actually dictate?
They dictate one thing and one thing only. When the holder is permitted to exercise the option, it has nothing to do with the geography of where the option is traded. It doesn't change the multiplier. It doesn't change the strike price. It is purely an exercise timing rule.
Let's break them down. American style options. These seem like they are built for, like, the impatient trader.
They're built for maximum flexibility, yeah. American style means the option is exercisable at ANY time up to and including the expiration date.
So Pete could wake up on a random Tuesday, 3 weeks before expiration, spill his coffee, panic about the news, and just say, I want my futures position right now. And he can just do it. He absolutely can. The right is his to invoke whenever the market is open. Now, contrast that with European style options. These are exercisable only at expiration. Usually it's restricted to a very specific time window on the actual expiration date itself.
So Pete can jump up and down on a random Tuesday. He can scream at his monitor all he wants, but Carl just stares at him with that barcode face and says, access denied. Come back on the expiration date.
Correct. Carl will just reject the exercise notice flat out.
Okay, here is the absolute easiest way to memorize this, and it's beautifully simple. American equals anytime. They both start with A,
yeah.
American, anytime.
Yeah.
European equals at the end, European, N.
Right.
Both start with E, American, anytime, European at the end.
That is a flawless mnemonic. Honestly, write that down. But let's take it a step deeper because I want you to understand why both styles exist in the first place.
Yeah, because that actually makes no sense to me. Why would anyone buy a European option if an American option gives you way more flexibility? Does European style just exist to make things cheaper?
Partially, yeah. European options can be priced slightly differently because there is no early exercise premium. But the real reason they exist is for the protection of institutional hedgers.
Oh, like wealthy Wanda.
The wealthy Wandas of the world, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine you are a massive institution managing a complex portfolio. You write thousands of options to hedge your exposure. If those options are American style, you have this constant looming threat of early assignment hanging over your head.
Oh, I see. So Wanda could be sitting on her yacht on a Tuesday, relaxing, and suddenly her phone buzzes, and she's been assigned a massive futures position 3 weeks earlier than she planned. It totally ruins her whole hedging strategy.
Exactly. It creates unpredictable cash flow and margin requirements. It's a nightmare for an institution. European-style options give writers certainty. Wanda knows with 100% confidence that she will not be assigned until the expiration date. It allows massive institutional players to manage their risk with precision. That predictability is incredibly valuable to the market ecosystem.
That makes total sense. Okay, here's a trap. I know they'll spring on the exam. They'll ask a question about an American-style option, and they'll try to imply that because Pete can exercise at any time, the last trading day and the expiration date are somehow the exact same thing.
Yes. They love to conflate the concepts. You must keep them strictly quarantined in your mind. The style American or European only tells you when the exercise door is unlocked. It does not override the exchange's rules about when the secondary trading market closes.
Right.
An American option still has a specific last trading day that might be days before its expiration date.
Got it. Let's talk about what happens at the very end of the line. The clock runs out. Let's say, panicked, Pete drank way too much chamomile tea to calm his nerves, and he literally sleeps through the expiration date.
It happens more than you'd think.
The bell rings. Pete does absolutely nothing. What happens to his ticket?
Carl takes over. The clearinghouse algorithms kick in.
Yeah.
And what happens depends entirely on the moneyness of the option.
Yeah.
At that exact final second.
Moneyness meaning, like, if it's profitable or not.
Exactly. Let's start with a good scenario. If Pete's option is in the money, meaning it has intrinsic value, it would be mathematically profitable for him to exercise it. The clearinghouse does not want Pete to lose out just because he overslept. It would really damage faith in the market. So Carl uses a process called auto-exercise, or exercise by exception.
So the option basically just acts on its own.
Yes. The system automatically exercises any option that is in the money by a certain minimum threshold. Usually it's just one tick. So Pete wakes up the next morning, rubs his eyes, logs into his account, and boom, he has a brand new futures position and a variation margin credit.
Carl had his back. Beep boop, you were profitable, I took care of it. But wait, what if the option is a loser? What if it's out of the money?
If the option is out of the money, meaning exercising it would instantly result in a financial loss, Carl's algorithm simply lets it die. It expires worthless.
It just evaporates.
It evaporates. It produces no futures position, and Pete's total loss is locked in at the premium he originally paid to Wanda.
Which Wanda is very happy about, drinking her martini on the yacht. Now wait, is this auto-exercise rule absolute? What if Pete, in a moment of sheer madness, wants to do the exact opposite?
What do you mean?
What if he wants to exercise a losing option or abandon a winning one? Can he override Carl?
He actually can. The market provides a manual override known as contrary instructions.
Contrary instructions. That sounds like a fancy legal term for doing something really stupid.
It definitely seems counterintuitive. But yes, before the final cutoff time, Pete can explicitly instruct his clearing firm to submit a contrary instruction to the clearinghouse. He can tell Carl, hey, do not auto-exercise my in-the-money option. Or he can demand, I want to manually exercise this out-of-the-money option, even though it's a loser.
Why on earth anyone would do that is a massive mystery, but I'm going to put a pin in that because I want to circle back to it later.
Fair enough.
Let's lock in this timeline stuff first. Think about this, listener. Direct question for you. Listen to the setup really closely.
Pay attention to this one.
Pete is holding an American-style option. The last trading day was yesterday. But the expiration date isn't until tomorrow. Pete is looking at his screen, he's super nervous, and he just wants to cash out and walk away without taking on a futures contract. Can he just hit the sell button and offset his option today?
Give him a second to think.
He cannot. The last trading day is in the past. It passed yesterday. The offset door is locked. Since the option is American style, he can exercise it today, but that means he's forced to take the futures contract. He can never trade out of the option itself again.
If you follow that logic, you are completely immune to the timeline tricks on the exam. You just have to separate the trading window from the exercise window in your head.
All right, let's keep this momentum going. We know what happens when Pete exercises. Let's look at what happens on the other side of the ball. Let's talk about the mechanics of assignment, the matchmaking process between Pete, Wanda, and Carl.
This is a critical semantic difference you need to master. Exercise and assignment are two halves of the exact same market event, but they belong to different participants. You must never mix up who does what.
I like to think of this as the coat check analogy. Imagine Pete walks into a very exclusive, high-end restaurant. He checks his coat at the front, and the attendant hands him a little numbered ticket. That ticket represents his option contract. At the end of the night, Pete decides he's cold, he wants his coat. He walks up to the counter, slams the ticket down, and says, "I want my coat." That action demanding the coat is exercise. It is 100% Pete's choice. He initiated the action.
That is a perfect visualization of the buyer's agency. Yeah. They are in control of that moment. Now, let's look at the other half. Assignment. When Keith slams the ticket on the counter, he doesn't get to casually stroll into the back room, look at all the coats, and pick the one he wants.
Right. He can't say, "You know what? I want Wanda's mink coat."
No, because Carl is the giant, terrifying bouncer running the coat check room.
Just standing there blocking the door.
Exactly. Carl takes Pete's ticket, scans it, and then Carl walks into the back room alone. Carl looks at his ledger of every single person who checked a coat that night. Those are the option writers, and Carl decides which writer is going to be assigned the obligation to hand over a coat. That is assignment.
So Wanda is sitting on her yacht, maybe she's asleep, and suddenly she gets an alert on her phone from her broker. "You have been assigned." She is completely passive in this process. She can't dodge it. She can't negotiate. She can't tell Carl to go bother someone else. And Pete couldn't have picked Wanda even if they were best friends.
And this brings up a fundamental question of market structure.
Yeah.
Why does it work this way? Why sever the connection between the buyer and the seller? Why does Clearinghouse Carl insist on standing in the middle?
Yeah, if Pete bought the ticket directly from Wanda, why doesn't Pete just call Wanda?
Counterparty risk. That's the reason. Imagine a major market crash. Pete's option is suddenly worth $10 million. If Pete has to call Wanda directly to collect, what happens if Wanda's yacht sank and she's bankrupt?
Oh, Pete is just out $10 million.
Exactly. And if that happens, the entire market would lose faith and collapse. By placing the clearinghouse in the middle, Carl becomes the buyer to every seller and the seller to every buyer. Pete doesn't have to worry if Wanda is broke because Carl guarantees the payout, and Wanda doesn't have to worry about Pete. The clearinghouse absorbs the systemic risk.
It's actually a brilliant system. Okay, but let's look at Carl in the coat room. How does Carl actually pick Wanda? There are thousands of writers who are short that exact same option. Does Carl just throw a dart at a board? Does he sort alphabetically?
The clearinghouse uses specific exchange-approved allocation methods to distribute assignment notices to the clearing member firms. And you absolutely need to know the two primary methods for the exam.
Okay, what's method number one?
Method number one is random assignment. This is exactly what it sounds like. It is an approved, audited algorithm that operates like a lottery. It randomly selects an open short position in that specific option series. This is the standard default method for the vast majority of contracts in the market.
So Wanda's number just happened to come up in the bingo tumbler. Tough break, Wanda.
Exactly. But there is a second method, and this is where people trip up. Method number two is pro rata assignment.
Pro rata meaning proportional.
Yes. It is deterministic, not random. Instead of picking one clearing firm and dumping a massive assignment on them, the clearinghouse looks at the total open short positions across all member firms and allocates the assignment proportionally based on the size of their positions.
Okay, stop right there. Why? Why go through the complex math of splitting it up instead of just pulling a name out of a hat?
Think about the types of markets that use pro rata. It is heavily utilized in massive physical commodity markets, specifically energy, like crude oil and certain metals. Let's use crude oil as an example. The players in the crude oil options market aren't just retail traders like Pete.
Right.
They are sovereign wealth funds, massive multinational oil conglomerates, airlines hedging their jet fuel.
So the positions are absolutely colossal.
Colossal. Imagine an airline decides to exercise 10,000 crude oil call options all at once. If Carl uses random assignment, he might drop that entire 10,000 contract obligation onto one single clearing firm that happens to represent, say, one medium-sized oil producer.
It would completely crush them. It would bankrupt the firm overnight just from the sudden margin requirements.
Exactly. It creates a massive localized shock to the system. By using pro rata assignment, Carl takes those 10,000 contracts and spreads them out thinly across every clearing firm holding short positions, proportional to their size. Everyone takes a tiny, manageable piece of the burden. It protects the structural integrity and liquidity of the energy market.
That is fascinating. It's all about preventing the boat from tipping over. Okay, you know what's coming. We need to flag the traps. The exam writers love to prey on your assumptions about this matchmaking process.
They really do. Let's break down the three most common tricks they use to confuse you on exercise and assignment. Trick number one. The exam will give you a scenario that implies the buyer exercises and gets to pick the specific writer they want to assign.
False. Pete is locked out of the coat room. He never picks Wanda.
Right. Trick number two. The exam will word a choice to suggest the writer chose to be assigned because they saw, like, an arbitrage opportunity or wanted the futures position.
Completely false. Assignment is inflicted upon the writer. Wanda is just sitting on her yacht when Carl hands her the bill. She never volunteers. Ever.
And trick number three, which is probably the most subtle. The exam might state as a definitive rule that assignment is always random across all futures options.
False. Because pro rata exists for energy and metals, if you see the word always regarding random assignment, it's a trap. Do not click it.
Good catch.
Let me give you a quick memory aid to keep the agency straight in your head. Who is doing what? Think of the letters. The buyer invokes the right. It is UP to them. Buyer has a U, up has a U. The writer is assigned. It is done AT them. Writer gets assigned, A and A. The buyer acts. The writer gets acted upon.
That is an excellent way to organize it. The exam wants to blur the lines of control. Pete controls the timing of exercise. Carl controls the mathematics of assignment. Wanda controls absolutely nothing once she sells the contract. She is entirely at their mercy.
Poor wealthy Wanda. I mean, hard to feel too bad for her given the yacht, but still.
She'll be fine.
All right, let's shift gears. We need to enter the mirror dimension. We are talking about calls, puts, and directionality. Because once Carl signs the contract, we have to figure out who is holding what. I want you to imagine ominous sci-fi music playing in the background right now, because this is where candidates get their brains tangled in knots.
It gets very confusing very fast if you don't have a system.
Exactly. So if I exercise a put option, do I end up going UP or do I go down in the futures market?
Directionality is where you have to move slowly and methodically. We are lining up the resulting futures positions for both parties. When the dust settles on the exercise and assignment process, what is actually sitting in Pete's account and what is sitting in Wanda's account?
Let's start with a call option. Pete, our nervous retail guy, buys a call. He decides it's time. He hits exercise. What happens?
Let's go back to the fundamental definition. What is a call option? A call is the right to buy the underlying asset. In the futures world, buying the asset means going long. Therefore, if Pete exercises a call option, Pete the holder receives a long futures position at the strike price. He is now long the market, hoping the price continues to rise.
Okay, that makes intuitive sense. Pete calls, Pete goes long. But what about Wanda? She got assigned by Carl.
This is where you have to remember that the derivatives market is a closed zero-sum system. It's a perfect mirror dimension. For every long position created, a corresponding short position must be created to balance the equation. You cannot have one without the other.
It's like a tug-of-war rope. If Pete is pulling on one end, someone has to be pulling on the other end to create the tension.
Exactly. So if Carl just handed Pete a long futures position, Carl must simultaneously hand Wanda a short futures position at the exact same strike price.
Yes.
They are now perfectly balanced on opposite sides of the trade. Pete is long, Wanda is short.
Okay, call exercise. Buyer goes long, assigned writer goes short. Got it. Now let's flip the board. What about a put? Pete buys a put option to protect his downside. He hits exercise.
Let's apply the exact same logic. A put is the right to sell the underlying asset. In the futures world, selling the asset to initiate a position means going short. Therefore, if Pete exercises a put option, Pete receives a short futures position at the strike price.
And the mirror dimension dictates that if Pete is holding the short end of the tug-of-war rope,
Wanda must be holding the long end. The assigned writer of the put, Wanda, receives a long futures position at the strike price.
Okay, listener, I have a visualization for this that helped me immensely when I was staring at practice questions at 2 a.m. I want you to picture yourself standing in the lobby of a massive skyscraper.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
If you want to go up to the penthouse, what do? You call the elevator to go UP. So if you exercise a call option, you go UP, which means you receive a long futures position.
Nice.
But what if you have a huge bag of garbage? You put the trash down the chute. You exercise a put option, you go down WN, which means you receive a short futures position. Call the elevator up, put the trash down. Call means long, put means short.
That is a phenomenal visual anchor. Call up, put down. And the beauty of this is that once you establish what Pete is doing using that trick, you don't even have to memorize Wanda's rules.
Right, because it's just a mirror.
Exactly. You just do the exact mathematical opposite. If the elevator is going up for Pete, which is long, it must be going down for Wanda, which is short.
You know exactly how the exam is going to mess with this, right? They are going to offer multiple choice answers that have Pete and Wanda going in the exact same direction.
Oh, they do it constantly. They will say, upon exercise of a call option, both the buyer and the writer receive long futures positions. It sounds plausible if you are rushing.
But it's physically impossible in the market. It's like a tug of war with both people pulling on the exact same end of the rope. Nothing happens. The outcomes must always be perfect mirror images across the strike price. If you catch yourself answering a question and you've given Pete and Wanda the same direction, stop immediately. Erase it. You've fallen for a trap.
It's a closed system. The clearinghouse is simply matching a buyer and a seller to create one unit of open interest. One long, one short. Always.
All right, let's put the listener in the hot seat. Direct question time. Listen to this setup carefully.
Get ready.
Wealthy Wanda is sipping a martini on the deck of her yacht. Suddenly, her broker app dings. She has an assignment notice from Clearinghouse Carl. The notice clearly states she has been assigned on a call option that she had previously written. What futures position does Wanda have in her account right at this exact moment?
Give it a sec.
Seven. Eight. She is short. Let's walk through the logic. Why is she short? Because the underlying contract was a call option. The buyer, some nervous guy like Pete, called the elevator UP. That means the buyer went long. And since the buyer went long, Wanda has to take the opposite side of the mirror dimension. She must go short.
If you can reliably walk through that three-step logic, identify the option type, determine the buyer's direction, and then flip it for the writer, you will never, ever miss a directionality question on the Series 3.
Okay, let's unpack this next segment because this is where the actual money gets real, and it's where a lot of retail traders completely blow up their accounts. We are talking about margins, specifically the margin shock. The massive financial switcheroo that happens the exact second an option is exercised.
This is one of the most heavily tested concepts because the financial obligations of the parties change drastically, literally in a split second. We have to examine this in two distinct stages, before exercise and after exercise.
Okay, let's look at stage one, holding my option. The option is alive. Nobody has exercised anything. Let's look at panicked Pete first. Pete is the option buyer. How much margin does Carl demand from Pete while Pete is just holding the option?
Zero. Absolutely no margin is required from the option buyer.
And this is exactly why retail traders love buying options. Think about my lottery ticket analogy from the beginning of the deep dive. Pete walked into the gas station and bought a scratch-off ticket for $50. He handed over the cash. That $50, his option premium is paid in full. It is his absolute maximum possible loss.
Right, he can't lose more than what he paid.
Exactly. If the ticket is a loser, he just throws it in the trash. He doesn't owe the gas station more money. Nobody is margin calling a guy holding a scratch-off ticket because the risk is capped.
Precisely. The premium he paid completely covers his maximum systemic risk. Therefore, the clearinghouse doesn't need to secure his position with margin. But what about wealthy Wanda? She is the writer. She sold that ticket. Her risk profile is on a completely different planet.
Right. Wanda sold Pete the ticket for $50, but the contract basically says, if the market crashes, I might owe you $1 million. Wanda collected $50, but she has theoretically infinite exposure.
And Carl, the cyborg referee, knows this. Carl looks at Wanda's open-ended risk, and Carl says, I don't care how big your yacht is. I need proof you can pay. Because of this massive, undefined risk, Carl forces Wanda to post performance bond margin while the option position is open.
So she has to lock up her capital.
Yes. She must keep a substantial cash deposit on file at the clearinghouse just to prove she has the capital to handle a worst-case market move.
Okay, so stage one summary. Pete buys the option, pays the premium, posts zero margin. Wanda sells the option, collects the premium, but has to post heavy margin. Now here is where it gets incredibly dangerous. Stage two, the moment of exercise.
The switcheroo.
Yeah. Pete decides he is in the money. He hands in his coat check ticket. He hits the exercise button. The option vanishes from existence. What happens to the margin requirements?
This is the monumental shift. The second Pete exercises, the option is gone. Poof. Pete and Wanda are no longer an option buyer and an option writer. They are now just two ordinary futures traders holding live opposite futures contracts. And here is the brutal reality check. Live futures contracts always carry margin requirements.
Always. So Pete, our nervous buddy who owed zero margin yesterday, Pete, who thought he was safe because his risk was limited to his little premium payment, suddenly he holds a live futures position.
Yes. And with that futures position comes massive new obligations. Pete is now immediately subject to initial futures margin. he has to post a deposit just to hold the contract. And far more critically, he is now subject to daily variation margin. His new futures position will be marked to market at the end of every single trading session.
So if the market suddenly turns against Pete's new futures position, Carl's algorithm is going to trigger a margin call. Pete's phone rings.
Hello, Pete. It's Carl. You are down on your futures contract. Wire me $5,000 by 9 a.m. tomorrow, or I am liquidating your account. Exactly. Pete went from having zero margin obligation and strictly limited risk to having full futures margin obligation and theoretically unlimited risk simply by clicking the exercise button.
That is a terrifying reality if you aren't capitalized for it. But wait, what about Wanda? She was already posting margin as an option writer.
For Wanda, it's just a transition. She stops posting option writer margin, and she simply begins posting standard futures margin for her new position. She's also now subject to daily variation margin, marked to market every day, just like Pete.
Okay, listener, I am jumping up and down, waving a giant red flag here. I want you to listen to me very carefully, because my instinct was wrong on this, and I guarantee the exam will try to use your instinct against you.
It's a huge trap.
The test will ask a question like, does an option buyer ever have to post margin? Your brain is going to remember stage one. Your brain will shout, no, the buyer only pays the premium. Wanda pays the margin. But the answer is yes, the option buyer does have to post margin, but only after they exercise the option and take delivery of the underlying futures contract. Do not assume the buyer never posts margin rule carries past the moment of exercise.
That is one of the highest frequency errors candidates make. They memorize buyers pay premium, writers pay margin as an absolute immutable law of physics, but it is conditional. It is only true while the option is alive. Once exercise occurs, the option is dead. The old rules are dead. You are now playing by futures rules.
And futures rules mean everybody pays margin.
Exactly. And the exam will try another trick in this same vein. They might describe an assignment scenario and imply that only the assigned writer has to post margin after exercise, because they were the ones punished with the assignment.
That's totally wrong.
Yes, completely wrong. Both sides have live futures contracts. Now, Carl doesn't care how you got the futures contract. Whether you actively exercised to get it like Pete or got passively assigned to get it like Wanda, you have a futures contract now. Therefore, both sides are subject to initial and variation margin. Equality under the margin rules.
Carl is a ruthless equalizer. Okay, take a breath, shake it out, roll your shoulders. You have just absorbed a massive amount of incredibly dense, complex market mechanics. We are moving into the rapid-fire recap.
Let's do it.
This is where we hammer the final nails into the board. We are going to alternate fast-paced takeaways. Lock these in. Ready. Go.
Exercising an option on a future produces a futures position. It does not magically hand you a physical commodity, and it does not hand you a lump sum of cash.
The last trading day is the absolute final deadline for offsetting your ticket in the market. The expiration date is the final deadline for exercising your ticket. They are not the same day, and trading always ends first.
American style means you can exercise any time. European style means you can exercise only at the end, on the expiration date. A for any time, E for end.
At expiration, in-the-money options automatically auto-exercise. They act on their own to save you. Out-of-the-money options quietly die and expire worthless. Unless you use contrary instructions to manually override Carl's algorithm.
When it comes to assignment, Clearinghouse Carl assigns wealthy Wanda. Panic Pete does not get to pick her, and Wanda cannot dodge the assignment. Carl usually does this randomly, but uses pro rata assignment for massive markets like energy to prevent systemic shock.
Directionality. Call the elevator UP, put the trash down to win. Exercising a call makes the holder long, which forces the assigned writer to go short. Exercising a put makes the holder short, which forces the assigned writer to go long.
And finally, margin. Option buyers pay strictly zero margin while the option is open, but they face full futures margin and daily variation margin the exact second they exercise and create that futures position.
Boom! That is the recap. If you conceptually understand the logic behind those bullet points, you have conquered the beast. But before we let you go, we want to leave you with a final thought.
Something to chew on.
Yeah, something that proves how deeply strange and fascinating these markets actually are.
Yes. Earlier, we briefly mentioned contrary instructions, that manual override where a trader can explicitly tell the clearinghouse to stop a profitable in-the-money option from auto-exercising or force an unprofitable out-of-the-money option to exercise.
Right, the doing something stupid rule.
Well, I want you to think critically about market efficiency. Why on earth would someone intentionally abandon a winning ticket or exercise a losing one? What incredibly complex tax implications? What impending physical delivery nightmares on the underlying futures contract? Or what extreme localized liquidity crunches would make a seasoned professional trader look at a profitable asset and say, "No thanks, Carl, let it die"?
It's crazy to think about.
It is. Ponder the hidden, invisible forces that occasionally make the irrational mathematical choice the only right choice as you continue your Series 3 journey.
It is a wild mystery, but a great reminder that these markets are living, breathing, infinitely complex ecosystems. Keep reviewing your notes. Keep drilling those adaptive practice questions on CertFuel. And remember, Pete is long, Wanda is short, and Carl always gets his margin. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. You've got this exam. Go crush it.